All right, so we're going to go ahead and get started with the next panel, title of which is Future Role of Non-IO Therapies, the Sad Tale of Neglected Targets and Companies in the Race to IO Domination. In addition to that rather bleak title, we have the auspicious honor of trying to wake people up after lunch. So please caffeinate, tune in. We want to hear lots of questions, lots of dialogue, and it should be a lot of fun. So let's get started. Okay. So I'm just briefly going to walk through a couple of slides, and then I'll pass it off to a couple of my panelists to do the same. Just by way of review, about 5 years ago, it seems like a long time ago, but not so long really, we were mentioning tumor immunology, or IO as it's now known, in the same breath as things like targeted therapy, like ADCs, cancer metabolism, epigenetics. As we now know, looking more recently, it's hard to believe there was ever a world in which we didn't look through the lens of immunotherapy in oncology. And a lot of that is hype, arguably, but a lot of that is justified. And I think the reasons are highlighted here, one being that A, PD-1s and the like are seen as the tip of the iceberg, and B, more importantly, that we're seeing long-lasting responses in an yet ill-defined but very clear subset of patients. And the question is, how can we expand upon that? Just again, to review and to keep things grounded, it's easy to forget that the vast majority of revenues projected or actual are coming from non-IO assets, but the growth curve for IO assets, of course, is I think what's caught a lot of people's attention. At Defined Health, particularly in the oncology group, this was a fun exercise to just kind of walk through the assets around which we were doing projects over the years and the mechanisms of action that they can be bucketed in. As you can see, in very short order, immuno-oncology projects have really taken over the lion's share on a proportion basis of the oncology work that we do, a reflection of what's happening in the marketplace. And just to show some data which kind of states the obvious point that I think a lot of you know, whereas IO deals are being done much earlier in the life cycle of a development stage product, non-IO products are going much later. And to underscore that point, just a few kind of headlines showing that while non-IO deals are being done, generally they're predicated on some pretty convincing data. So I have a number of different questions for this panel, which we'll come back to, I think, after some of my panelists talk. And okay. Well, with that, I'll pass it on to Lou Bender to present his work.
Could you put up the slides, Daryl? Thank you. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. I appreciate the Defined Health, Joel and Jeff Bachman's invitation on the topic of the sad tale of neglected targets and companies in the race to IO domination, and I'm glad it's not the tale of the neglected targets and sad companies in the race to IO domination. I appreciate that. So really, as we heard from Bruce Booth's group this morning, really is the R&D pendulum so far to the IO side that nothing is really else being considered. And really, that's a major problem if that is indeed the case. And I'd like to show you some data on how good PD-1 drugs really are in a mouse model. So here you have anti-PD-1 in a colon 26 tumor type. And the black curves that you see there are no treatment. And the blue curve is PD-1. Now, unfortunately, this is in a tumor really not in a tumor. It's injected cells. 2 days later, they dose the PD-1 for BI twice weekly, two times, four times. And you can see that there is inhibition of growth. Maybe 20% of the time there's no growth in these types of cells, but let's assume that that one tumor that didn't grow was a complete response. And this was data published by Charles River in AACR. In 4T1, which is another syngeneic model, you can see how good PD-1 is, and this is a PD-L1, but PD-1 behaves exactly the same. You can see almost no difference between no treatment, ibrutinib, and anti-PD-L1 alone, and then there's some benefit to the combination, hence everybody moving to combinations. But again, this is not great results. So let me talk about a novel target. I won't tell you what it is, but this is data that was presented by the National Cancer Institute in an oral keystone presentation last year. It's a new target. In tumors, actual real tumors, greater than 200 cubic millimeters, which is quite large, one drug cycle, very low dose, 100% of the animals regressed from baseline, and there were 80% complete responders. That same drug in 4T1 in actual established tumors, 125 cubic millimeter tumors, one drug cycle, only 3 days, 4 mgs per kg again, 50% animals regressed to zero. It's a very metastatic tumor, and in that region, it's a fat pad induction of the cells, but you could see that it regressed the tumors, and then there was some regrowth. In the animals, again, presented by the National Cancer Institute, you could see that the animals that had a complete response, first they were inoculated. Here you could see they were inoculated with a rechallenge of the cancer cells, 1 million cancer cells. Nothing grew. This line up here is 6 complete responders. And then you can see they were re-inoculated 3 months later with a IV inoculation of the cancer cells, and all the control animals died, and the animals here survived. They were kept till almost the end of their life, and then they were re-inoculated for the fourth time, or the third re-inoculation, let's say. The tumor started to grow, and they were cleared. A long-term durable response over the lifetime of the animal for this novel target. So more on this novel drug. It's U.S. and patents are issued. An IND was accepted by FDA and CTA by Health Canada. Manufacturing has been scaled up and has shown 6 months of stability in a commercially viable dosage form, and it's now in clinical trials. There's no data yet. So the question I would like you to consider is, do a show of hands here in a second. If the drug were an IO antibody, would it be more or less or no different in value to an agent that is not an IO antibody? I'm not telling you what it is. How many think that this drug, just what you've seen, would be more valuable if it were an IO antibody? A couple people. How many think it would be less valuable? Less valuable? And how many say it's the data, it's no difference? And how many people are not listening to me here? Well, anyway, okay, so a little bit, you're not really sure. Let's go with that. Then the next question is, based on that information, and I'm not telling you what the drug is, should this drug be of interest to pharmaceutical companies? How many think it should be of interest to pharmaceutical companies? How many of you are from pharmaceutical companies? So anyway, and how many think this would not be of interest to pharmaceutical company? I'm not telling you if it's an IO or not IO. And if it were not an IO, how many people think it would be of interest to pharmaceutical companies? Not an IO. Okay, so there's some. Okay, good. All right, well, that's one of the neglected targets. It is, that is not yet of interest to pharmaceutical companies, although some of this information has not been shared. But I won't tell you what the drug is at this point. We'll leave suspense for later. And that's just the topic of non-IO.
Provocative.
No interest. Sad companies with no interested products.
All right, can we get Russell's slides?
Do you want me to stand or should I?
Whatever you prefer.
I just can do it here.
Yep.
Joel, thank you, and Jeff, thank you for inviting me to be on this panel. We're a little bit of an outlier in the sense we are kind of an IO company, but having spent the last 3 years trying to get people interested in a in a novel target that no one's ever heard of, I can say we got plenty of sad and plenty of neglected. And so we're not, so we do fit in on some level. We are a spin out of early stage company, spun out of Harvard MGH, and we're making antibodies to TNFR2. So we started the company actually trying to make agonist antibodies in autoimmunity with the idea of expanding the Tregs. And our CSO kept finding these antagonist antibodies that could compete with TNF, and they killed Tregs. And so we, you know, this was in the early stages of what we thought was immuno-oncology. And so we thought, okay, we have an interesting target. And we started around talking to people, potentially partnering, because TNFR2 is expressed on a population of Tregs in the tumor microenvironment that we think is really interesting. And then as a classic example of it's better to be lucky than good, we were approached by Stanford, and it turns out that they had discovered that TNFR2 is actually an oncogene. And that started a collaboration where they sent us samples, and we showed that we could directly kill tumor cells with our antibody. So the last couple of years, we've started to see a little more pickup in the space, and people also interested in TNFR2, the group at Stanford. There was a paper from the Broad that was published in Science this fall showing that TNFR2 is a dominant protein in the tumor microenvironment, and then AstraZeneca and MedImmune, in collaboration with the University of Cambridge, published a big paper on OncoTarget on TNFR2 in the tumor microenvironment. So we've started some collaborations in colon cancer and show that colon cancer expresses TNFR2, working with Dana-Farber. We have an ongoing collaboration with UPenn in melanoma, looking at PD-1-resistant patients and our antibody and how they express TNFR2, the group in Stanford around the oncogene, and we're working with our own OBGYN group at Harvard looking at ovarian cancer, and I'll show you a little bit of those slides. So this is a chart I took from the AstraZeneca paper, and it basically just shows in these 15 cancers, and actually the original version of the chart is 20 cancers, but it doesn't look very good, so I had to shorten it, that the y-axis is expression of TNFR2, and the x-axis is T-cell infiltrates. So you can see a strong positive correlation showing that TNFR2 is highly expressed in the tumor microenvironment. And so as we move forward, we think these are some of the cancers that we would approach. It'd be a diagnostic approach where you can see if the cells express TNFR2 and then have a dual mechanism for targeting, direct killing, and then also, for our next slide, we'll get back to that, and expanding the, by taking down the Tregs, we show we can expand the T effector cells and so have that basic approach in immuno-oncology. Question we're asked all the time when we talk about Tregs is how we compare with the other targets. GITR and OX40, members of the superfamily, and we think the expression of TNFR2, again, I stole this from the AstraZeneca paper, is actually much higher than GITR or OX40 in the tumor microenvironment. So just a little tiny bit of data about us, and the black is control, the blue is ascites fluid of ovarian patients, and you see a dose response that we can take down the Tregs pretty thoroughly. And the normals don't really respond, and that's because TNFR2, one of the reasons it was ignored for so long, is it's not widely expressed in the tumor microenvironment. And at the same time you're taking down the Tregs, you're expanding the T effector cells, and that's the graph on the right. And this is just a little bit of data from our collaboration with Stanford, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, showing the direct killing of on the right of the tumors, and then the taking down of the Treg population in the tumor microenvironment. So I didn't want to do a commercial for the company, but I just want to give some context of what it's like to be out there with a target no one's heard of, you know, trying to get people excited in it. But we think there's a little bit of momentum in that TNFR2 could be, you know, a hot new area for companies looking to combine and with resistance. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Russell. So we have a great panel. We have, I would say, three representatives who currently sit in the biotech seat and two who sit in the larger biopharma seat. So why don't we just give Eric Rowinsky a chance to introduce what he does, what Argenx is doing, and then I'll introduce the other two panelists.
Thanks, Joel. Well, I have a great title. I'm the executive chairman and president of Argenx, and it really means I do nothing. I really don't have a full-time job. And it's largely because I'm not a believer. I think that you know, I used to have a hard time with a lot of my colleagues who I just remember, you know, I really believe in this target. And, you know, it's beautiful when you believe. And you basically can do a lot and you find out many beautiful things in science. And I've just never been kind of that person who can believe in a target. But I do believe in execution. And I think that you have to execute flawlessly. And my focus has largely been in clinical strategies and clinical development. So I kind of like to dabble in many targets, and that's probably why I don't have a full-time job these days. And Argenx is kind of I've been working with this company, and I'll describe their platform in a second to you. And I have the maybe just being a non-believer, I'm able to dabble in many things. So I'm kind of the Rolling Stone in oncology. I'm just rolling around, but it gives me the opportunity to see many types of targets, and I think that only data and data really that we basically collect through flawless execution will tell us which targets are going to really be impactful in oncology. I hate when the pendulum swings. In find ourselves on the extreme of that pendulum swinging, and I think we're sort of in that an extreme now because it really prevents us from evaluating targets that are on other sides of the pendulum, and even companies that purely don't have IO targets. And I'm digressing a little bit, find themselves having to call themselves IO companies, and even combining their drugs irrationally with PD-1 inhibitors and a variety of other IO targeting agents. I'm currently involved with Argenx, which is a company that is spun out of Rockefeller. Largely, my involvement is because Argenx is agnostic, like I am, to targets, but has a very novel platform. And Argenx actually spun out of Sahil Tavazzoli's laboratory at Rockefeller, and the laboratory utilizes a technique that is kind of cumbersome. It's not really terribly scientific. It involves a lot of work, where it's sort of a takeoff on Isaiah Fidler's work, where you basically take, let's say, four tumor cell lines. We'll pick KRAS mutant cell lines, or two cell lines from a KRAS mutant colorectal cancer cell lines, two tumors from a patient. So you have basically four tumors. You start injecting these tumors into mice, and you start selecting for tumors that are very aggressive, that set up shop in the liver. So you keep doing these selections. So you start out with a tumor that may not be as aggressive, or four cell lines that may not be as aggressive when you start out. You end up with tumors that you've selected after multiple passages that are highly aggressive, that establish themselves very readily in organs such as the liver. Now you take those tumors and you basically say, well, and this is Sohiel's laboratory, what's different about them with regard to gene regulation, what genes are turned on? And we do that by assessing the microRNAs in those tumors that we've selected from the four that we've started out, and we compare them. And you'd think that you'd just get a gamish of genes that are all over the place, some repressed, some increased. But we generally find a very few genes and that are common to these cell lines, and we use some mathematical programs to actually make this determination, and we then assess which targets are being turned on, what are the targets of those genes, and then we target those targets. Interestingly, the genes that we basically that turn out to be differentially expressed, and this is really pretty fascinating, often come from the same pathway. And those genes and those targets are often regulating the microenvironment. For example, that the vasculature and the immune system. Now, the first target that actually came out of one of these runs, and this was basically from four cell lines that were melanoma cell lines, was APOE. And you think, well, what is ApoE doing in you know, why is ApoE being repressed or in these tumors? Lo and behold, we initially found that low ApoE, and ApoE has certainly been a target in cardiovascular disease and also in dementia. And in cardiovascular disease, industry was basically targeting low ApoE with LXR agonists to increase ApoE because low ApoE was associated with plaque formation in the heart and also the microglial excitement in the brain, which really are cementing blocks in the process of cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. It turns out that cancers also have low ApoE, and very aggressive cancers have low ApoE. So we are actually targeting a target called LXR that increases ApoE, and when we increase ApoE, we see a very substantial single agent activity in a number of tumors. Lo and behold, the microRNAs are ways in which tumors basically turn on a dime, you know, and regulate the microenvironment so they can basically grow. We found out that low ApoE is associated with increased angiogenesis, and no one was interested in our targets, you know, initially. And we felt that the angiogenesis was part of the story, but it wasn't the full story until a laboratory next to ours at Rockefeller demonstrated that MDSCs were basically shut down and reduced substantially across a wide range of tumors. So now we have an IO drug, a lot of interest, and we've just basically entered the clinic. The platform has also revealed a number of other targets. Some are IO targets and others are metabolic targets. And then again, allowing the cancers to actually turn on a dime, produce energy, turn on the blood vessel growth, and shut down the immune system or turn on the immune system. Long-winded.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Eric. So we've heard three different companies, three different unique targets, one which is a little mysterious, but nonetheless, I think speak to the question that is central theme to this panel, which is, does it matter if you're IO or not? What does it even mean? What is IO versus 9-0? Is that distinction real? And if you see data where you have an asset flatlining tumors in mice, is that driving value in and of itself, or does it speak more to, or is the value driven more by the mechanism of action and the potential for synergy in combination with other approaches? I think these are all questions we can delve into. Let me first give Peter over at the end a chance to introduce himself, and I'll also ask him to ponder the question as someone who sits high up in strategy at Astellas, whether he believes the IO-non-IO distinction is real and what role it plays.
So my name is Peter Sándor, head of marketing strategy and oncology at Astellas. And in this role, our team or my function is overseeing pipeline activities from the very beginning to the very end of the products when patent expires. Our role is, and that's what I will represent here in this discussion, is to look at all of these, what we are discussing here and today, to look at all of these from the market perspective. And market means many things, from the patients to the physician to the payers, where some pressures are increasing and changing some of the things what we do or what we think will be viable in the future. Before I get to this couple of words about the company, as Astellas is relatively new as a company, it has been founded about 10 years ago by a merger of two other Japanese companies. And at the time, the company decided to get into oncology. It had no oncology presence, no oncology discovery, no development, and no commercial capabilities. So the way to get into a new therapeutic area is that you buy into this new therapeutic area. You buy the technologies, the platforms, and the assets. So that's the way which provides a lot of opportunity, an almost a piece of white paper when you can design what will come. So this led us to a partnership with Medivation, or now with Pfizer, on Xtendi in prostate cancer, which is a growing, continuously growing blockbuster program, or to Tarceva in non-small cell lung cancer, or other region-specific programs in products in Japan and Europe. And behind these, we acquired technologies, large molecule capabilities, what the company didn't have before, acquiring a company called Agensys in Santa Monica, Southern California, as well as started to build a partnership with academia around unique target, unique drugs, unique approaches. And as the market evolved, we started to think about and get into immuno versus non-immuno-oncology approaches. And we are in this unique situation where our pipeline has both type of approaches. We have not had any immunologic capabilities in-house, though the company has some transplantation ongoing businesses, but not on the discovery side anymore. So we have started to build up partnerships with academia, like MD Anderson, or partnering with MPM Capital to put in place early stage company by the founders to start to build up novel IO mechanisms. So what it shows you, that what we really believe in, or what we are look at, is the expected benefit what the technology or the drug will deliver, regardless what the mechanism is behind it. Having said this, we have to recognize as well that some of the mechanisms are more likely to deliver benefit than the others, but that at the end, most of them will be combinations. Most of them will be used sequentially, maybe in a more advanced way than it is today. But it means that it requires multiple different targets, multiple different technologies to address the problems that the patients have. So when it comes to IO versus non-IO, does it really matter? We spend all of the morning, almost all of the morning, I believe, talking about IO. And if you can grab those slides, what we have somewhere in the backup.
I had it, but I lost it.
Okay.
Thought it was on there.
So there is there's a recent analysis which shows how many drugs in oncology in the pipeline overall are non-IO versus IO. It is about one-third of the entire oncology pipeline IO. Two-thirds is non-IO. So if we are thinking about here sad tale of non-IO therapies, then somebody got this wrong. Either those companies who are developing these assets or investors who are feeding these companies, or we are all doing the wrong thing on the other end. So it's probably, the truth is probably somewhere in between, where either, again, combination or different sequential use of this treatment, thinking about orthogonal use of different technologies to address from debulking to maintaining to more response at the end. So what are we looking at when we assess different technologies from a business development or partnering or licensing perspective, be it early stage or late stage, like the recent acquisition of a German company with absolutely outstanding clinical benefit in gastric cancer and other malignancies. So it's truly the benefit or the expected benefit that the technology can deliver, risk-benefit ratio, if you wish. In early stage, you can't really tell, especially not from a commercial perspective. But what we are always looking at, whether the whole package, the data package, is cohesive enough, whether we understand the relationship between the outcome and the benefit, not just from the clinical benefit as a single target perspective, but whether these different drugs or technologies can be combined with other standard of care products where the intended indication and the intended use will be. Some of the areas where there are already today definite unmet needs, and those came up a couple of times during the discussions earlier, patients who are refractory to checkpoint inhibitors. It seems there are great solutions where, like, we are moving forward antibody-drug conjugates in bladder cancer for including patients who are failing or failed in checkpoint inhibitors, and there is no other solution today. But we need to consider in these cases whether these technologies can be moved into different spaces where either, again, combinations or different type of sequential use can play a role. The other area is the large amount of patients who do not respond to checkpoint inhibitors today. The question will be whether those patients can be identified upfront and we don't need to wait until they actually fail on these drugs. So all of these assumptions are built on or factors what we are looking at, build on some assumptions. What I would like to raise as the last point, just highlight the high risk of both IO and non-IO development. The assumption that the checkpoint inhibitors will stay with us as the standard backbone therapy is an assumption as of today across the tumor types. And I believe payers and providers will have something to say to this idea, either to commoditize the market or put in place other measures. The other aspect is whether these patients who are responsive or non-responding to certain technologies can be identified upfront as a single agent. And that's an assumption still. Right now, not even patient enrichment technologies are at the stage where we can certainly say who is responding and who will not respond. And then lastly, when it comes to combinations, then it becomes even more tricky and more complex. So will there be any technology which helps to identify patients and predict what different drugs need to be used for a certain tumor biology? So net-net, there is not much difference between IO and non-IO from a business or development perspective if you take the future market perspectives in place.
Great. Axel?
Same question. GSK has aligned itself somewhat differently. As you said, you came in with somewhat of a blank slate in the oncology group, but there's clearly some concentrated plays in IO, cell therapy, epigenetics. Can you speak a little bit to the role that the IO, non-IO distinction plays at GSK?
Yeah, so I can just extend on what I've heard so far. Our strategy has been to focus on innovation, focus on new mechanisms, and expand on expertise that we already had created in-house. And, you know, there is no prejudice towards IO versus non-IO, but clearly when you're having a strategic objective of creating transformational medicines, you turn towards where you are most likely to find that. And based on everything we've seen, you can get transformational medicines in specific targeted therapy areas. You can get them in IO. And when it comes to long-term durable benefit and hopefully overcoming resistance or not even allowing resistance to develop, IO seems to offer more than targeted therapies. I'm just making that statement. That's what we're operating with for now. You know, we have both in our pipeline. We have epigenetics, which is largely targeted therapies, all small molecules. And we then have a spectrum of different modalities that fall under the IO umbrella. So as it comes to, you know, contemplating what would be interesting to a company like GSK as we expand our pipeline, we do a lot of homegrown innovation. So we make new molecules ourselves. A large part of the pipeline is actually homegrown. Entirely epigenetics is homegrown. Some of it of immuno-oncology is. And we look at complementarity to our current strategic approach to look at new molecules that could be of interest. So now, having said that, when we look at the distinction of IO versus non-IO, I agree largely that the lines get more blurry over time as more and more companies actually consider to characterize what their agents can do to the immune system, since most medicines that we give are given systemically. Very few exceptions to that exist. Systemic administration includes the immune system. And you do see more and more that we are beginning to understand what does chemotherapy do to the immune system. The concept of immunogenic chemotherapy has been coined. What do targeted therapies do in lymphocytes? Could some of them actually be originally invented for anti-tumor effects, later recognized to also have immune modulatory effects, be that positive or negative. Some of them are actually negative, and you might not necessarily want to use them for IO combinations. But what that means is the lines are not as sharply drawn as you might want. So I still make a distinction between the two, because true IO mechanisms should give you true immunological effects that are immune responses driven towards the tumor and should give you long-term therapeutic benefit, including memory, and that is a unique aspect of the immune system. But then there are a lot of gray zones where non-IO therapies have immunological effects, and they should be considered. And, you know, I've seen at J.P. Morgan in 2013, the first year when the IO wave for BD started, companies renamed themselves. They went from "we are a cardiovascular company" to "we are a cardiovascular immuno-oncology company." And things like that, you know, some of it is just positioning, but some of it is actually reality. We're beginning to learn what the non-IO agents can do, and they're not just focused on the tumor. So I think at the end of the day, the non-IO space has its justification, and it is actually older than immuno-oncology, and it will play a role, especially when we come to combination therapy.
Great. So what I'm hearing is that one can separate the focus on IO as an asset or as a therapeutic modality and IO as an endgame, in the sense that one needs to figure out ways to create an optimal anti-tumor immune response, regardless of what the assets are. Is that a fair statement? And I'll just put that to anyone who wants to raise their hand.
Joel, I'm sorry. You said that the focus would be to create a favorable immune response?
An anti-tumor immune response. And the question of what the modality is that's getting you there is almost secondary.
I think that... The key is more, you know, I think when a company looks at, certainly with regard to in-licensing, and investors look with regard to investing, it's potentially just seeing something that's finite, seeing something that is rational, potentially able to, one would be able to select the right patients or the right tumors for that particular modality, regardless of what it is. So one could actually prove concept quickly and move to a pivotal trial and move through a pivotal trial rather quickly. And I think that, you know, that is economically feasible. I think if one looks at models of NPV, you know, short, very finite periods of development really stack up very high. Of course, there's always, you know, the concept of how big that population will be. So I think some of the targets that fit that particular phenotype are often targets that are very rare targets, and I think we have to contend with that side of the spectrum as well. But I think it's largely proof of concept, a clear science, and a clear pathway forward, yeah. Regardless of IO versus non-IO.
I'll tell you my experience. That data I showed you is our drug, obviously, and it's not IO. It's an intratumoral, converts the tumor to a, saturates the tumor and can kill the tumor very effectively, converting it into your own personalized endogenous vaccine. Very strong killing agents and very strong immune response. And when I went to a, I'll tell you two anecdotes. I went to a big pharma company, and I showed them the data, and the guy was very interested, business person, and he said, I'll bring it back. I'll bring it back to our team to evaluate. And they looked at it, and they came back to me, and they said, look, our strategy is A, B, and C. And this is D. We don't do D. Even though your data is better than anything we've seen, it's D. That was preclinical. He did say, of course, if you come back with human data showing these kinds of results, our strategy will be D. It will definitely be D. So that was encouraging. The second story was I went to another pharmaceutical company, again, top 10, and I showed him the data. And the guy looked at me, head of business development, and he said, You know, Lou, you'll probably cure cancer, but no one will use it, son. And I thought myself, you know, that's so wrong. I am way too old to be called son. My dad doesn't even call me son anymore. But the other component of no one will use it because it's not the modality we dose, which is intravenously, this is at the time, is just typical and very, and was just actually blew me away that that could be said. You'll cure cancer, but no one will use it. So clearly that was, you know, I mean, it's probably miscommunicating. I probably didn't understand it, but I'm pretty sure I did. And you see that it is the mechanism. It is about human data, but it is also the mechanism. And the mechanism has to fit within a defined context of what's in the strategy. And if the strategy is antibody-drug conjugates and the strategy is targeted therapeutics and the strategy is IO, that's the strategy. And don't tell me about the data or the other strategy. That has been my experience until you get to humans, and then it's game on. If the data in humans is significant, it doesn't matter what it is. So I think there's a preclinical clinical divide with regard to the thinking on IO versus not IO.
And you went on to demonstrate with your asset or with your platform that there is an immune
element. Oh, there's definitely an
element to it.
The National Cancer Institute's presented data at multiple conferences with our compound showing there's a strong CD8, CD4 activation. Yep. When you put anti-CD8, CD4 in there, you don't get this kind of you still drive it down, but you don't get the complete response.
So does that get you any additional enthusiasm from people opposite the table of you?
No. They look at it and they say, okay.
Well, I want to give our pharma representatives a chance to respond, but maybe first, Russell, what's been your experience trying to go out and sell a exquisitely interesting and selective Treg inhibitor and one that targets tumor cells to boot?
Well, you know, we get a lot of positive response on the basic science. Even our CSO is super charming and gives great presentations and, you know, multiple hour, month-long conversations back and forth about the science. But ultimately, it comes down to it's a new target. And I think what Lou said about A, B, C, and D is true. You know, and you get – then you get into a company and they basically – it might mean they have to kill something internally to take something else in, and that's a really hard decision for them to make. So as an unknown target, it's a risk, and then you're putting risk on someone's plate. And that's a hard thing for an employer or a company to do, to take on risk on an unknown target, first-time CEO. And the science is from an immunology lab that didn't know oncology until 2-3 years ago. And so I think we're just trying to wait it out. We get more data, some out of these collaborations, and sort of wait for the field to catch up for us, which seems, when I first heard it and people explained to me, you know, you need to get other people working on it before people will get interested in you, it seemed ridiculous. Like, wouldn't being the leader be the best, or being the first out there be the best? And it isn't. For some reason, it's easier to have, you know, 4 or 5 of the peer group working on the target than be, you know, the only player in that game, no matter how interesting it is.
And I don't want to lose focus of the panel topic, which is IO versus non-IO. And your asset, I would say, is kind of squarely in the the IO camp.
Well, I think everything from what we're hearing today is going to be somewhere in the middle. I mean, most things are. Mm-hmm. And we think for patients that do express, it'll be a highly, like HER2, a very diagnostic approach where we're a monoclonal antibody. And, you know, if you express TNFR2, you're probably a good candidate to get it. And, but then for patients, you know, the Treg problem is, as best I understand it, I'm not an immunologist, is a real issue in immuno-oncology. I mean, that population of cells dampens the response. And a lot of things target Tregs, but do they do it exclusively? And if you wipe out all the Tregs, you're going to get autoimmunity and a lot of complications that we're seeing. I mean, I was at the ADA, the American Diabetes Association Annual Institute last year, and there were PD-1 posters, you know, PD-1 patients getting type 1 diabetes. And so these issues are real. So the Treg problem, I think, is going to be for all forms of IO. And whether or not it's TNFR2 or another target, I think Tregs are important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we heard the analogy of everyone kind of moving to the ball. earlier today, and perhaps that's where we are with I.O. But on the end there, Peter, what, there has to be a reason for, well, first let me ask, is there an A, B, and C, and then a D? And if so, is that perhaps the function of maybe people who are a little bit lower down in the company not getting the remit properly, as opposed to if you talk to someone a little bit higher up who's looking more on kind of an agnostic fashion at the asset?
There is always a D or an E and F strategy, of course, even though A and B and C are the defined ones. But there are certain aspects what at least we try to assess in these cases. If you show up with something which eliminates the cancer in these models, it's a pretty clear picture to me. But again, I'm the marketing guy, so I see that patients will be treated this way, then it's good for everyone. There's a risk which comes with it. So what the primary assessment on our end and consideration is whether we move resources from strategy ABC, where those resources are allocated, and there is no free resource in this world. Whether we allocate this to D, whether the expected outcome justifies the incremental risk which comes in. And it's a soft discussion. There is no hard line that there is no D because we decided on A and B and C. And we have shifted resources and directions a couple of times, even in this 10-year period, when we realized that there may be better options coming in our way to put this in the pipeline. So there is no black and white answer. There must be a D, especially if the technology works well.
Yeah. Okay. Axel, you know, we've seen the watershed moment for I.O. 5 years ago or 7 years ago, I put up that slide. We were talking in the same breath that other like-minded modalities or mechanisms of action, such as epigenetics, tumor metabolism, angiogenesis. The question of durability, I think, has grabbed everyone's imagination and resources. But is it possible that there's another tipping point around the corner for some of these other non-IO mechanisms, and perhaps we're kind of blinding ourselves a little bit to the possibility of such a moment, given the intense focus on IO?
I wouldn't say we are actually blinding ourselves. We are going with a wave that we have been waiting for a very long time. Think about how long we've tried to make the immune system work against cancer. It's at least 30 years of serious clinical investigation. Mm-hmm. If you count back to William Coley, it's more than a century. So it's a matter of perspective. We've been waiting for using our own natural defense mechanism against cancer for a long time, and we're just scratching the surface to actually effectively do that. And given the features that the immune system has as compared to a targeted therapy that's designed for one specific mechanism, it's adaptable. It has memory. It's a living thing. It can be much more flexible around fighting the disease than any specifically designed individual therapy can be, which is one of the reasons why we keep seeing resistance with some of the targeted therapies. Even for very highly effective targeted therapies, you get quick responses. They last a certain period. The tumor outsmarts the thing and circles around it, and you get relapse. So at least for many, that's true. It's not always true. But, you know, having said that, you need to just create the situation in which the maximum benefit that now more and more is being demanded in oncology. You know, I think we're departing from the era of marginal improvements to an era of more transformational medicines, which is a good thing because that's what patients want. That's what ultimately the payer system will demand, because we're asking for large price tags for these therapies. They've got to deliver something in return. So I think with time, this concept of cure or chronic disease of cancer is going to become a reality for many patients, not just a handful. And then, you know, every therapy that we can introduce to achieve that will play its role, targeted therapies included.
I think part of the enthusiasm is especially in the IO
beta IO inhibitors and the IO targets is the fact that, you know, we do know limitations. Our limitations, or at least we think we know our limitations, at least more in basically non-IO targets. We know things about tyrosine kinase inhibitors and mechanisms of resistance and the limitations of these drugs and cytotoxic chemotherapies. I don't think we know the limitations yet. And it may be very limited. It may be limited to the, you know, the PD-1, PD-L1 axis inhibitors, or it may be, you know, it may expand, and hopefully it will. But, you know, we don't know, you know, but that statement that I just made is, you know, has to be taken with a grain of salt, because there are some agents, and I think Mark Retain, and sitting and looking at me here, is we've been around in the 90s when the PARP inhibitors really didn't, we didn't do them justice. And, you know, that's two decades ago, and now we know so much about these agents because we've thought about them, we understand the science a little bit more. So I think that, you know, I think that we often don't know the limitations of many of the agents and many of the targets that we even think we know the limitations of. So I'm really being a bit existential here. But I think that, yeah, certainly, you know, the IO inhibitors just basically open up this whole dimension of possibilities that really may not be dependent upon any fixed lesion in the cell, which makes it so, you know, the potential so great.
And I look at the, you know, what Bruce said this morning was that there are 20 IO, 20 PD-1s behind in the clinic, and 60 potentially behind that. And if you have a PD-1 and you're trying to develop it as a monotherapy, really, how are you going to compete if you're the 17th PD-1 to the market, or even the third? How are the maybe the PD-L1s have some opportunity? But how are you going to compete if you're not looking at either a combination to the marketplace with something unique or something unique alone that might be as good or better? How are you going to compete, and why are you spending money on the 20th, 19th, 18th, 10th PD-1 alone? It makes no sense. You have to look at non-IO to make a difference if PD-1 is going to capture the vast majority. And how are Bristol and Merck, with such a lead, going to lose it to another PD-1? They're spending the money to maintain it. And the IO, the non-IO targets are the way for these companies to potentially make a difference. If they don't have it and they're only spending on PD-1 or something similar, it's going to be tough.
Is it better, and maybe I'll put this to Russell, is it better to try to combine with IO or to try to best IO or carve out unique niches in places where IO isn't likely to make an impact on its own?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're targeting that with our collaborations right away, because I think that's going to be the hot topic. And we're seeing the first generation of PD-1 patients develop resistance now, and that data is going to keep coming out, and then all the side effects. And so for us, it's a quick opportunity. And, yeah, there are 20 to 60 going to come out, and every single one of them is going to need some form of differentiator, or they're going to not have value. So be aware. You know, I'll think what I'd love for the oncogene to work. It almost seems like science fiction, because, you know, I didn't show the slide. HER2 is expressed on over 30 cancers. So we're going to be HER2 for 30 cancers instead of just for breast cancer. I just can't even, it seems too good to be true. And you're kind of silly when you say it. But, yeah, we would love to be a targeted therapy. But I think most likely what we know we can do and love to do is be part of this immuno-oncology process with a PD-1. Or you know, another combination.
Yeah. So I guess, again, what I'm hearing is the idea that we need to figure out a way to harness the immune system, and whichever way gets us there is perfectly acceptable. Do we have a handle on how to monitor those patients in real time? And if not, and I guess this is a plug for NanoString and diagnostic companies, for which are positioning themselves to address this issue, but also I think face a challenging play, is are we trying to
figure out which patients are going to be resistant to a PD-1 inhibitor a priori, or are we thinking about ways to target specific mechanisms, whether it's IO or non-IO, for those resistant patients? And if so, how are we gonna get there?
Before I was the CEO of, before I founded this company and was the CEO of a treatment to try to find a cure for cancer, I was the CEO of a diagnostic company. And let me tell you, that is a hard business.
Yeah.
The cure for cancer versus making money in a diagnostic business, the way you've outlined it, I say that's much harder than what we're trying to do. It is a tough business to get reimbursement, to find the diagnostic that they work. There aren't markers, and Axel said it this morning. There is no way to predict who's going to be responsive right now. And there's people looking to potentially it's a burden, like a mutagenicity burden, but it is a hard business to form a diagnostic. It really is.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
So then what am I missing? So how do we figure out how to get at these patients in a better way than just kind of throwing PD-1 plus the kitchen sink at them?
Yeah, so we are, of course, it's a hard business if we do it in isolation. Nevertheless, we will need it. There's no way around it. To direct these therapies properly in the right place, it needs to be biomarker work, and I know it's a simplified terminology. But we need biologic markers that help us identify the patients that will respond or that have an immune status that is, you know, amenable to a certain intervention. So if we do this in collaboration with diagnostic companies, if we do the diagnostic work in-house, if we partner it, if whatever the mechanism, we still have to do it. And it starts with basic science, assay development, lots of variability, some clinical observations paired with biomarker data. And then it goes into validation, choosing one assay over others, harmonizing this across a broader spectrum of stakeholders, and then go and make a companion diagnostic with the winner, preferably. That would be the best scenario. But yes, how this will be done from a business perspective of the diagnostic company, there is a challenge there.
That's the harder part, because you've got the Myriad decision on patentability. You've got the Merck Integra on the use of intellectual property. You have the reimbursement issue. You have the coding system, which is archaic and needs to be changed. So the science is hard, but the business is really hard too. And I think that makes it a big challenge for anybody, a smaller company for sure, and potentially even for large companies to try to integrate all of that information and business. You might want to just walk away from the diagnostic as a business if you can develop a drug where you can select with it. That might be the solution, but for a small company, that's not possible, really.
Yeah. Peter, what's the role? I know you have a phase 3 product in AML, and it's a targeted agent, FLT3, AXL inhibitor. And obviously, organizations like Leukemia Lymphoma Society have put out their Beat AML trial, which is a kind of large master protocol. What's the role of regulatory science in some of these adaptive trial designs, which may help find homes for targeted therapies where an empirical approach may not work?
Well, I don't know the regulatory path of these trials, at least as I have seen those discussions are ongoing since a while to get basket trials and based on these outcomes directly to the FDA. I'm not sure whether it works unless you confirm the outcome of these studies in a specific regulatory or label-enabling study. On the other hand, when it comes to diseases like AML, where lots of driver mutations are identified, that's a relatively straightforward process, so maybe some opening here in the future. When it comes to FLT3 itself, that's a well-known target. It's not that difficult to identify even in institution-based tests, not just companion diagnostics. So there is a straightforward path for the specific asset, and basket trials are interesting questions, but I'm not sure, again, how will it work.
Okay, so I'm going to open it up to questions in a moment, but I guess before that,
Just picking up along that theme, Eric, you know, just asking you to put on your medical oncology hat, are there other indications or settings that may prove to be recalcitrant to PD-1s and the like over time? And if you are a small company trying to position yourself with a non-IO asset, might make more sense than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think one can only speculate. I tend to think that the more we know about how tumors generate and how the immune system works. I mean, what came first? I mean, is the immune system, I'm being rhetorical, of course, responsible for the tumors that some of our novel therapies that are at least impactful are impacting? Did the immune system go awry initially in the genesis of melanomas, renal cell carcinoma, and even lung cancers to some degree, you know, as an initial event? And now we're basically correcting that event. I'm certainly not an immunologist, and you know, maybe tumors like colon cancer have very hard fixed genetic events that really are extrinsic to the immune system. I don't know. I can only speculate until someone comes along or we do an investigation of immunomodulation and have significant responses in the vast majority of colon cancer outside of microsatellite instability. So, I mean, obviously there are tumors in which, and, you know, I'm sure the other panelists and others in the audience can speculate on this better than I can, that are really very fixed very rigid in terms of their responsiveness. I think colorectal being one, potentially pancreatic, prostate, maybe some elements of breast cancer. And I think that may relate to the immune involvement or the immune system's involvement in surveillance and knocking off cancers as they form or cancer cells as they generate. But certainly there are tumor types, some of which I've named, that are innately resistant, at least for the time being.
Yep.
Thank you very much. The panelists were great. It's nice to be introduced to the cure for cancer as it was unveiled for the first time in a large audience.
Well, hopefully.
This will be on television one.
Well.
One of the themes, both the last panel and this, is how hard it is to find the patients, especially with targeted therapeutics. How hard, I agree, diagnostics is. Is it inconceivable? And Mark and I talked. I keep on telling Mark this. Is it inconceivable to have every time a patient's tumor is removed or biopsied, that immediately the industry pays for some full diagnostic panel? I know somebody from Foundation is here and is nodding his head positively, but and then we would know not only a lot of information, but we would know if you're eligible for clinical trials. If you have a TNFR mutation or a track or whatever, we would know because you know with 5 or 6%. Of patients enrolling on trials, and there's 1,000 drugs in clinical development, often the same drugs. So I mean, we got to first reduce those. But at least you know, can we at least have the protoplasm out there? Maybe PHRMA, somebody pay for it, and then the company that uses the patient pays it back. Is that an inconceivable dream?
No, other than the fact that the NCI is a part of government, you'd think that NCI would have, or maybe the Moonshot program should be this repository that should enable the characterization of tumors on a wholesale scale. I've always thought that the NCI should have taken on that role. But, you know, can industry do something like that? I think it would be wonderful. I just think there's so many impediments to that, but it's a great dream.
So is not this whole separation between IO and non-IO drugs artificial?
You know, if you look at TKIs, they're involved in immune subset conditioning. Axel, you refer to, it's traditional chemotherapy being immune stimulants. I mean, in ovarian cancer, we use cisplatin basically to stimulate the immune system so the PD-1s can work. So to me, it all merges into one thing.
Mark Retain. I think the NCI is actually trying to do this with, their match protocol, which started out matchless, and I thought they maybe needed a match.gov commercial or something like that. We actually have had some patients match. Now, whether the drugs are going to be useful is another whole question, and I think most of the time, Rob, we see these data on a large number of patients, and there's almost nothing useful in these reports that you didn't know about already, like the patient with pancreatic cancer has a KRAS mutation or something like that. So,
I have two friends recently who just got diagnosed with
Well, and again, there's the therapeutic misconception that because you go on a trial, you're getting treatment. Trials, as the ethicists remind us, they're not treatment. They're to gain knowledge. And, we of course, as physicians, we want to help patients, but maybe we're doing too much trying to help and actually not generating the knowledge that we really need to help. And that's another whole debate.
I think it's a very difficult technical problem because everybody's cancer comes from their own genetics, which is different. What you've been exposed to, what caused the cancer over your life is different. Every tumor is different, and every tumor has heterogeneity that is different. So what are the tests that are going to be validated in a diagnostic on tissue that's going to really be allowing that kind of heterogeneity amongst tumor types, people, and what they've been exposed to really come up with a validated assay that can tell you what to do, I think is a challenge that is, I'm not sure, technically solvable, in my opinion.
I'd be curious what the panel thinks. I don't know if the risk of technical success is actually less difficult for immuno-oncology than non-IO, but I think there's a perception, which could well be unfounded, that anything that says IO has the potential to be transformative, as Axel said, and is going to command a premium price, whereas much non-IO is still seen as possibly just being incremental, and it's going to fight in the marketplace. Do you think that's the unfair perception that's underlying a lot of this discussion?
It has something to do with it. It's not black and white, but yeah, it has something to do with it.
I agree.
Other questions? Anyone from any brave biotech reps representatives who want to speak to their stories of a non-IO mechanism, or people on the pharma side who can defend or at least explain the rationale for how they get enthusiastic about certain programs versus others?
So I had a question about PARP inhibitors. They seem to be kind of the next big deal in the non-IO category. Can you guys speak a bit more about them? And just are there any other big modalities or, mechanisms of action that seem to be kind of on the rise in the non-IO space that you guys see?
Well, I wouldn't say on the rise, but I remember I used to do a lot of advising for pharmaceutical companies maybe 10 years ago, and you'd walk into the business development meetings and or their offices, and there'd be a blackboard with prioritization of targets and be a little square at the bottom, and then that square would be immunomodulators, cancer vaccines, and RNA, which was really low down, micros, siRNA, and and certainly we've had some companies that have, I think if we could, siRNA and a variety of RNAs are used to
basically test hypothesis in the laboratory. We can cure cancer in the laboratory very well. We, in a whole variety of cancers. Problem is cancer vaccines. I should even add oncoviruses. If we can deliver them, and I think that the big challenge is delivery. If we could basically, and I think, I also think that the pendulum has really swung in the other direction in companies that have, you know, novel delivery platforms. And we're all shying away from that. Certainly money is not going, investment money in that direction. And there are some very novel delivery possibilities, including using immunological cells. I'm working with a company now that's packing mesenchymal stem cells with a variety of different targets because they can home and they're non-immunogenic. So I think there are a number of tools that are out there that probably even hold a greater potential than IO because, gee, you know, a tool like an siRNA, if it can be delivered, and we've seen it in neurological diseases. Biogen and Ionis have had a drug just approved about 4 months ago for spinal muscular atrophy, which is just a game changer. They have to deliver it into the spinal cord, into the brain. And of course, there's gene therapy. So I think those categories, if we can deliver genes, I think we need to focus a bit on delivery, on honing, on selectivity. And I think we have the tools if we were to really understand those mechanisms. But who's going to do it? You know, where's the dollars? Where's the interest? And
yeah, so look, I've been doing this for almost 35 years, lots of companies, lots of successes, plenty of failures. And I find the whole topic of IO, non-IO, for somebody who's been around a lot, a little pretentious, to be honest with you. Honestly, every couple of years, every decade, whatever, there's a new way of looking at things, and it either works out or it doesn't. Targeted therapies were the last. But at the end of the day, it really does come down to data. And I was a person who was instinctively raising my hand every time when the question was asked originally, would you be interested in such a product? I think the problem is that if you look at it in this highly discriminatory way, IO, non-IO, whatever the flavor of the month is, you really do your own product a disservice. And you're also not listening to what other people are telling you, which is if you are the only company out there with a particular target, you have a big hill to climb. We all know that, right? So to me, biotechnology is really built on people with a tremendous vision and the courage to go after that vision. And if the vision is an new or unknown target or a new or unknown technology, bless you, go forth and try to conquer. And I've been unable to interest VCs in certain ideas that I thought were terrific. Most of the time they turned out not to be so terrific, and occasionally they did. So I think it's really, at the end of the day, down to data, and I don't know anything else to say than that. Finally, with regard to A, B, C, and D, every large company, and small for that matter, only can have a certain amount of expertise. And if you don't have expertise within your company to be able to effectively evaluate a new technology, it's very hard to go out and do it on a one-off basis. So that's why our big company brethren, which I was one once, really rely on their bench of scientists and clinicians to do that. And I think anybody who takes that the wrong way and sees the everything kind of against them, that's not a very that's probably not correct. It's just the way those companies have been focusing their energies and efforts.
I think you're right. You're absolutely right. Look, it is about the data. It is about what you can do with it. And every VC turned us down. Every pharma company didn't. A lot of pharma companies didn't even want to see it. Wouldn't want to even see the data. So we have three billionaires who've invested in the company. You don't need many of them to get to a human data. We operate very lean, and we'll have the data. And it's the data, like you said. It's the data. And you persevere, and you get the data, and then you see what it is. If it works well, it works well, people will be interested, patients will want it, doctors will want it, pharma companies will want it, and everybody will want to invest. You have to have the data. That's what you got to get. So I agree completely it's about the data. When it's human data, when it's other data, it's not, it's within what we're talking about.
So, Chip, to your point that you just made, I mean, obviously the idea was somewhat of a straw man, to put it out there, and then there's no doubt that the data should speak. So, frankly, I find it abhorrent that there's this D or E, you know, where at least someone wouldn't consider it, but let's put that aside. However, I think the distinction does have practical implications because you may look at how you measure, how you track, how the trial is designed for an IO agent versus a non-IO, right? I mean, one might argue that many of the vaccines, which were at the forefront originally of IO, and which gave IO much of its bad name, failed, not because they didn't necessarily work, but because those trials weren't designed, the patients weren't followed in the appropriate way, because they were looking for standard, you know, response rates in a narrow time frame, et cetera, rather than a vision of, oh, they had no idea it was going to be this tail end effect that they would be looking at. So I think there are implications in terms of trial design. And it also was, your point is germane to one of the questions I wanted to ask, which there wasn't a specific discussion of, are there certain places where IO might be better deployed versus non-IO? So, for example, in the many patients in certain tumors that you can't resect, sure would be great to have something that goes above and beyond radiation, et cetera. So if you're going to have some type of non-IO agent that's going to debulk, that's going to be cytotoxic. Now, that still may lead to immunogenic cell death, but again, it may work differently and in the nearer term where you might need organ sparing or preservation of organ function than an IO agent that's going to kind of take its time to work. So any comments in closing before Ginny cuts us off?
No, but I'll add that there are also there's such an enthusiasm for IO trials amongst patients who are hearing it in you know every medium possible that and for investigators as well and institutions that want to have those trials that there are these trials in irrational tumor types and settings that are probably competing with agents that are substantially more rational, companies that just don't have the ability to compete and put those trials in terms of resources in the same institution may have to go abroad to do those trials. So I don't know. There's a lot of the pendulum has swung and so has some craziness in terms of, you know, what we're doing. And, you know, patients are ultimately going to suffer from this.